Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Death and dying are difficult topics for any of us to discuss. But recently, due to books like Atul Gawande's Being Mortal and Jessica Zitter's Extreme Measures, we've seen an upsurge in people willing to talk about death and discuss the values they cherish as they approach a death they want, often less likely to occur in a medical setting. My guest today, Lucy Kalanathi, is an internal medicine physician and was widowed when her husband, neurosurgeon Paul Kalanathi, died before his 40th birthday in 2015. Lucy Kalanathi completed her late husband's memoir titled When Breath Becomes Air, which came out in 2016 and rocketed to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. She's going to be in Tulsa next Monday night as part of Claire House's Dying Dialogues 2017. The event will take place at TU's Lorton Performance Center with a reception beginning at 6 p.m. and a talk at 7. The event is free and open to the public and is co-sponsored by Magic City Books, who will have copies on hand, as well as TU and OU Tulsa. Dr. Kalanathi will sign books at the end of the evening. Lucy Kalanathi delivered a TED Talk at TEDMED in 2016 that's been viewed more than 1.5 million times. She's my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Lucy Kalanathi, welcome to Medical Monday. For those that haven't yet been lucky enough to read the book, When Breath Becomes Air, can you tell us a little bit about your husband, Paul Kalanathi?
Sure. So my late husband, Paul, was a neurosurgeon and writer. He was 36 when he was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer and died about 2 years after the diagnosis, just after we had a baby. And so he wrote this memoir about the experience of being a patient and a physician both, and about really wrestling with big questions about life and death and meaning.
He had he was in his sort of final year of residency, either when he got sick or when he died. So he had almost completed the long journey to become a neurosurgeon. Tell us about what it takes, how many years, and what kind of education it takes to become a neurosurgeon.
It's 11 years after college. So if you go to college and then do 4 years of medical school, you graduate and you're officially a doctor, but you train in your specialty. And if you're training as a neurosurgeon, your residency is 7 years. And so Paul was in the just about to start the last year of residency when he started to lose weight and developed a cough and then back pain. And ultimately, you know, you're working so hard at that point, you know, you can have some of those symptoms just from your hard work, but ultimately it turned out not to be that. He was diagnosed with metastatic cancer.
Yeah, and I think he wrote in the book about the sort of the percentage, I think it was something like 0.0012% or something of 36-year-olds who get stage 4 lung cancer. I mean, a very small percentage of people. So he was incredibly unlucky in that way.
Right.
One of the things that makes him so special, in addition to writing this memoir, is he really wrestled. Medicine was not a straight path for him. And he earned a master's degree in English literature. Tell us about his journey through English and finally deciding on medicine. What was some of the thinking behind that?
So Paul really surprised himself by going into medicine. He studied English literature and history and philosophy of science and medicine. So he was sort of a philosophical person and a big reader. And he was really funny. He was a comedy writer in college. He was sort of in the like literary philosophical world. And then became really interested in questions of meaning and sort of what does it mean to be a human being and what does it mean to have, you know, a physical body that you inhabit and your brain is just another organ like your other organs, but it sort of gives rise to who you are and your sense of self. And he became really interested in kind of the mind-brain duality in neuroscience, which was a real surprise to him, and ultimately ended up entering medicine and wanting to be a brain surgeon because he sort of really wanted to be at these critical moments with people where they're making life and death decisions and they're really thinking about who they are and what's meaningful to them. But it was a circuitous path and then certainly not not where he thought he was headed. But it turned out to be a really good fit.
And you and Paul met, I think it was in medical school, is that right?
That's right, yep.
Was your background sort of straight in terms of going to medicine as well?
A little more straight. I thought I was going to be a math teacher, and then I thought I was going to be an engineer. I really liked math and science, and then, you know, I was joking around the other day, when you're writing your application for medical school, most people write, I like science, and I like to help people, and that's like literally the crux of your med school essay, and then you try to say it in a creative way, and so I think, you know, Paul could say that, and I could say that, and kind of ended up in medicine. Similar reasons, you know, it's like you have this real interest in the science of it, but then you want to put those skills to use, like, face-to-face with other people. And it was sort of the first time I felt like I was using all the parts of my brain at once, you know, like science, language, empathy. So I feel really lucky I ended up there, too.
You mentioned that Paul, at least in his college career, was a humor writer. And throughout the memoir, you know, it's very clear how much he reveres many different writers and getting to these philosophical questions about what it means to be human. But he also definitely has this sense of humor. And he talked about, and I think I watched, you gave a TED Med Talk, so a TED Talk about living and dying, in which you mention, and it's in the book, about his gorilla costume. Can you tell us a little bit about the gorilla costume and some of his other pranks that he pulled?
Sure. So Paul had this gorilla suit that he used to bring out sort of at crazy moments. I think he spent a day as a tourist in London wearing a gorilla suit once, and he may have worn it to someone's wedding at one point and gotten in huge trouble from the bride. And then I first fell in love with him, realizing how funny he was. I knew he was sort of serious and smart and a good student. He was one of the sort of, I don't know, really impressive people in our med school class. But then I realized a few weeks into school that Paul was wearing a fake mustache in his medical student ID.
Are you serious?
And isn't that crazy? It's insane. And he had, like, pulled this big bushy mustache out of his pocket and wore it when they were snapping that photo. And I don't know, because I wish I could ask him really what his thinking was, like whether it was, you know, totally just a game time decision or if it sort of meant something to him to have that sort of funny, irreverent piece of him trailing him into the hospital. But he was, you know, 3 years later, he's applying to be a neurosurgeon, and that picture with the fake mustache is on the face sheet that all your supervisors and attendings can see. So he was sort of famous in our class for having this sort of ridiculous thing following him around.
Oh, that is hilarious. I want to ask you, too, about the book project. The book, for those that are just kind of coming to it for the first time, is called When Breath Becomes Air, and it's a memoir by Paul Kalanithi. And if you know anything about medical writing, the foreword is by Abraham Verghese, who is also a famous medical writer and novelist as well, wrote the novel Cutting for Stone. And I think in one of the essays that you wrote that I read, it was sort of, you asked, I think it was either his agent or the editor, sort of like, well, how's this book going to do? And what was the answer you were given?
She said, well, it's either going to do very, very well, or it's going to do absolutely terribly. And I remember being like, I really wish you could give me more specifics. But, you know, I think it's a book by somebody who recently died, and it's a lot of the book is talking about dying or suffering, you know, as he's the patient himself, and he's a neurosurgeon treating people. But I think ultimately it's a book about life and living. And she was sort of talking about that, like, will people not really want to pick up a book that sounds like it could be, you know, depressing or something? But I think people are interested in these questions. And, you know, it became a bestseller, and I think it indicates something about the zeitgeist.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Lucy Kalanithi. She is the widow of Dr. Paul Kalanithi, whose memoir, When Breath Becomes Air, became a massive New York Times bestseller. And Dr. Lucy Kalanithi will be visiting us in Tulsa next Monday on October 16th at the Lorton Performance Center. She'll be part of a dying dialogue put on by Claire House, also sponsored by Magic City Books, the University of Tulsa, and OU Tulsa. And Lucy Kalanithi, I'm certainly glad it did turn out to be such a big bestseller. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the craft. You had to shepherd this project to publication because, unfortunately, Paul died before it could be completed, and he'd written most of it. And tell us a little bit about, you know, how you did that.
I'll back up just a little bit. So Paul, when he was sick after the diagnosis, wrote a short essay that ended up in the New York Times. It was called How Long Have I Got Left? And it was about identity and uncertainty in the face of illness, and it went viral and led sort of really fortuitously to this book deal, totally unexpectedly. But he'd always been a really good writer, and when he couldn't be a surgeon anymore, he shifted to writing, and he worked really passionately and hard on completing most of the manuscript before he died. And then when he died, it was sort of he'd secured the book deal with the publisher, Random House, but it was still a bit of a question, like, can it still be a book? And you know, how's this going to work with the book tour and the author side? And so I worked really closely with the editor to put it all together, and we added in some of Paul's writing from other periods in his life, including things from emails or his master's thesis, or for people who've read the book, there's a piece about anatomy lab and what it feels like to be a medical student in the anatomy lab, and he had written that as a medical student, for example. So we inserted some other various writing, and then I wrote an epilogue to the book that talked about, you know, the way Paul died and a little bit reflecting on what's been happening since and then who he was as a person. And then the book came out in early 2016, and I got to do a book tour for him, which turned out to be amazing during a time of grief. I loved it.
I was wondering about that. So it was a time of grief, but did connecting with audiences in this way help you through the grieving process?
Absolutely. It's been so meaningful and interesting to talk to people who've been through all different kinds of hardship, and it sort of makes you feel less alone in the experience of suffering. And then I think certainly just having the chance to talk about Paul has been so nice. And I think, you know, when somebody dies, oftentimes people are afraid to talk about them or bring them up, or they're afraid it'll be awkward or they'll make you more sad or something. But for me, it's been exactly the opposite, that people ask about Paul all the time because of the book, or, you know, strangers ask me about Paul, or I get to talk to you today, and it's just awesome. It makes me feel, you know, like able to have a conversation that oftentimes we don't have a chance to have.
I wanted to ask you also about Paul's oncologist, Emma Hayward. I think if I remember in your talk, your TED talk, you mentioned that you received several bouquets of flowers when Paul died, but there was only one bouquet of flowers that you actually sent. And can you tell us about that?
Sure. So I sent flowers after Paul died to Paul's oncologist. And some of that was just like, I really missed her. You know, you get so intimate with your treating physicians. And we were so used to seeing her, and she had been so in it with us, obviously. But then it was also really a thank you, because she really paid attention to what was important to Paul. You know, she listened to what he was hoping to do, and she, as an example, she really was thoughtful about which chemotherapy drugs she was recommending, because she wanted to avoid side effects that would prevent him from continuing to be a surgeon. And she just was so really invested in who he was as a person, and I think I was so grateful for that.
I thought it was pretty impressive how, even at the very beginning of their relationship, she wanted to know what his values were. That is, would you want to go back and continue to perform surgery, which I think it seems like initially he thought was going to be off the table with this diagnosis of terribly advanced cancer. So it was very impressive.
Right. I mean, initially I think both of us thought that was insane too. And I think some of that has to do, though, with sort of the changing landscape in cancer science. You know, Paul lived around the median amount of time that people live with this cancer, which wasn't too long, but there have been some new drugs developed that are much easier to take than traditional chemo, and she knew that. So, you know, I think some of that was because of the science, but she really sort of held open those possible selves, you know, for Paul to continue to be or become.
So in his treatment, he first took the newer therapy, right, that in a way was going to have the lower level of toxicity, but then ultimately that sort of stopped working, and that's when he had to go to the traditional chemotherapy?
That's exactly right.
And, you know, one of the things she knew, I think, as you pointed out, is that cisplatin and carboplatin, these are two related but different cancer drugs, chemotherapy-wise, cause neuropathy, where it was going to essentially hurt his ability to, you know, have dexterity and use his hands in surgery, but ultimately it even affected his ability to type on the computer. And you were able to kind of help him through that. What did you do for Paul?
So because of one of the medications he was taking, Paul had really, really dry skin and like various types of acne and other sort of like skin issues that he had never had before. And one of them was that his fingertips were really sore and almost kind of cracked, sort of like when people have really severe eczema. And so we found these gloves, like the kind that people wear in the winter when it's really cold, but they're using their touchscreen phones. You can get these sort of silver threaded, like winter gloves. And so Paul typed a lot of the manuscripts wearing those, even though it was like summer in California, so that he could use the trackpad on his computer. So there were all kinds of things like that. We got an adjustable chair so he could sit for a long time but still kind of change positions because of back pain. And he was on a stimulant medication off-label for a little while, kind of like Ritalin. because of other medication side effects and fatigue from cancer. There was sort of all these like ways that we had to figure out how to help him do what he wanted to do, which was write.
In your epilogue to When Breath Becomes Air, you talk about how for Paul it was literally like racing against time. And, you know, I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on what you mean about that.
Sure. I mean, the concept of time is really interesting and all these various, I think Paul had a sort of complicated relationship to the notion of time, the feeling of time. One was that time was sort of speeding up, you know. He was trying to write this manuscript while he knew that his time was short. And then at the same time, we had a newborn. So time with her was just really, we were sort of really in the present and really focused on her. And Paul said this interesting thing at one point. He said time used to have this kind of linear progression feel to it. And now time feels more like a space. And I think about that a lot, you know, with illness or aging or whatever. It's like your relationship to your own future can change a lot. And I think Paul didn't have a relationship with the future anymore. You know, he was sort of only guaranteed the present. And in a way, that was wonderful and beautiful, especially having a newborn. And in other ways, it was like a race, like you said.
So your newborn, or at the time newborn, who's now, I think you said, three, Katie, what were some of the decisions you had to make, even in whether or not to try to have a child?
We decided to have Katie after Paul was diagnosed, and it was a really tough decision, and, you know, felt sort of crazy at the time and probably was sort of crazy, too. And we talked a lot about it. We'd initially planned to have children right around that time when Paul was finishing his neurosurgery residency. But, you know, the circumstances were so different now that he had advanced cancer. And I remember there was sort of this pivotal moment for me where he writes about this conversation in the book. But I said, you know, is it going to distract from time you have to do other things you might want to do? And do you feel like having to say goodbye to a newborn is going to make dying more painful for you? And I was really worried about that. And in response to that question, he said this really beautiful thing. He said, wouldn't it be great if it did make it more painful? Sort of getting at that idea of a lot of the things we do in our lives that are really meaningful, including parenting for anyone, whether or not you're sick, it sort of invites uncertainty and hardship and even pain, but also the opportunity for real meaning along with it. So I think that sort of bolstered my confidence in thinking, you know, maybe this is okay, and maybe it's even great to have a child under this circumstance. And we had a lot of support, and she was 8 months old when Paul died, and now she's three, and she's, like, potty training and really thriving and has this sort of big community around her. But it's, you know, I'm going to have to help her figure out who Paul was and who Paul is to her.
In one of your talks, you talk about, you discuss Katie and what you're going to tell her about Paul. How do you sort of imagine those conversations going, at least now that you've had sort of a couple of years more to think about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think about this a lot, and I'm really open to advice about this, too. So we talk about Paul a lot. We have a lot of pictures in our house of Paul. And then she knows a whole bunch of stuff about Paul. Sometimes she'll say, and I don't even know where, I haven't given her this language, but sometimes she'll turn to me and say, I was a baby with my daddy. And it's really interesting to hear her say that. And then I ask her questions about that or tell her things. And I made her a little picture book about Paul that's sort of analogous to, you know, like a book about Curious George or a book about Elmo or whatever. It's like she's really into books, and so I figured that's a way to communicate with her, too. So there's a book about Paul, you know, and then she's a character in the book, too, obviously, and it shows pictures of his grave, and she doesn't know what a grave is, but she can see those pictures and sort of start to put it together. So I think she'll just sort of grow up into knowing who Paul is, and then at some point she'll read When Breath Becomes Air, and I think that's going to be really interesting.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Lucy Kalanithi. She's an internist and clinical assistant professor of medicine at Stanford, and also wrote the epilogue to her husband's memoir, When Breath Becomes Air, by her late husband, Paul Kalanithi. And Dr. Lucy Kalanithi will be appearing here in Tulsa next Monday night, October 16th, at the Lorton Performance Center as part of a Clare House Dying Dialogue for 2017. It's free and open to the public, and we'll start at 6 p.m. with a reception, and then her talk will be at 7 p.m. There will also be a book signing put on by Magic City Books, and it's co-sponsored by Clare House, University of Tulsa, and OU Tulsa. And Lucy Kalanathi, I wanted to ask how, you know, your life has changed dramatically, both being a widow now and a mom, but also, you know, how you view your career. But you articulate fairly well in some of the material that I've seen where you've spoken. How does your time with Paul, or the experience with his illness and suffering and death, how has it changed your outlook on death and dying, especially because you're in the medical profession?
You know, I mean, I think my career has shifted to thinking more about end-of-life care now. I'm a primary care doctor, and that's sort of my first love in medicine, but now I think a lot about how to get people healthcare that sort of lines up with who they are and what their values are. And there's a lot of interesting studies about this recently. There was one survey that found that a quarter of people said that they or their family member received excessive or unwanted medical care. And I think there's sort of this trend in American healthcare to, treat acute health crises, but not be so good in helping with terminal illness or around when somebody's dying. And so I think thinking about palliative care and even kind of the boring stuff like advanced care planning, like advanced directives or power of attorney for healthcare, there's all this evidence that people are more likely to get care in line with who they are and better satisfaction of care and then less trauma for their families. If we're sort of addressing those questions of what does a good day look like and what trade-offs are you willing to make or not make in your healthcare for more time? And so I think those are really big questions that are important to think about, and that's part of what I'm very interested in.
I was really intrigued when you talked about an advanced directive, which I think we tend to think about either on the doctor side or the patient side as a very sort of dry, almost boilerplate physical document. And yet you, I think having gone through this with such being a young person yourself and a young husband, you framed it totally differently, that this was sort of a document or testimonial to your love. Can you help shape that for me?
Sure. And that framing sort of really makes sense to me viscerally now. I in that TED Med talk, I sort of conceived of that paperwork, like an advance directive or a power of attorney, sort of like a marriage vow, you know, like you're really saying that you are going to be there for somebody, and that if they can't speak for themselves, you will speak for them, and that you know who they are, and, you know, like you're going to be true to them in that time and help them in that time. And I think in a way that's really romantic. And then I sort of think that's part of this bigger framing in medicine of, you know, like we think of illness and healthcare treatment sort of like a war story, it's a battle and we're going to fight it and we're going to beat it. But especially when something's not curable, I think it is much more about a love story. And it's like, how do you be a witness to somebody suffering, and how do you stand next to somebody and as they're going through something? And so to me, I think that framing of, like a love story makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I thought that was really beautiful. One of the things I wanted to ask is, you are a two-doctor couple, and you chose internal medicine, which has typically like a 3-year residency. And as you pointed out, Paul signed on for neurosurgery, which has, 7 years. So he was really slogging away. And even actually after residency, a neurosurgeon typically is on call and doing very multi-hour operations and things. How did the balance of your workloads impact your relationship?
Yeah, good question. That was always in flux, kind of. In a way, the period when we were both residents, that first 3 years out of medical school, was almost easier. And then I think when our work hours kind of diverged, it got harder. And, that was a constant conversation about how are we going to balance that, and then what will happen after residency. And we actually, Paul illuminates some conflict over that right in the beginning of When Breath Becomes Air. He sort of includes a tumultuous time in our marriage as part of the prologue to the book, because that was all happening around the time of his diagnosis. And I sort of made fun of him at the time, like, this is your catchy intro to your, you know, they teach you in high school to write a catchy intro sentence. And I was like, you wrote your memoir and it starts out with marriage difficulty. But, you know, I think I'm really glad he wrote the truth about that, because I think a lot of families have that kind of question and it feels like the truth. I think if he hadn't written about that conflict, it wouldn't have been, you know, the full story.
That was really, it was quite a hook into the book, I think, and it was real, and I think people could relate to it. And I'm certainly, you know, being in, you know, medical practice, I could sort of personally attest to that, and just the challenges of that kind of never-ending, you know, schedule and schedule adjustment. You mentioned that, you know, your career now is more focused sort of on, you know, advanced care planning or caring for people near the end of life. Is that as a primary care doctor, or do you find that patients are coming to you more because of the sort of celebrity that's achieved by the book and looking for their elderly loved ones to come in your direction? Or is it just you still have sort of an overall general practice where it's people of all ages?
Oh, that's a really good question. So right now, I don't actually have my own patients in practice. I'm more in kind of an urgent care setting. So, you know, which is good and bad. It lets me travel and do other things related to book tour, but at the same time, I miss having my own patients. There have been a few times where people have told me while I'm doing a patient visit with them that they've read the book, and then there have been other times where somebody is going through something really hard, and I kind of want to tell them or connect over what happened to our family, and that's like a real question in medicine, like how much of yourself do you bring to the encounter, and is it okay to share something about yourself, and I sort of play that by ear. But in a way, it's less about the book and more just feeling connected to what's happening in, you know, people's lives, whether or not they know about the book, you know. And then I think the other thing is I feel sort of invested, really invested in, you know, helping people get healthcare that makes sense for them, and even thinking about, like, how do we measure quality in healthcare? Like, what does quality care mean? And so that applies in my everyday work a little bit more than thinking specifically about end-of-life care.
Yeah, I mean, it's something we're forced to think about now, especially with all of this healthcare reform and reform to the reform, et cetera, and how mm-hmm. we pay for value care. Well, Lucy Kalanathi is an internist and clinical assistant professor of medicine at the Stanford Medical School. She's also the widow of Paul Kalanathi, who's the author of the best-selling memoir, When Breath Becomes Air. And she will be the guest of Claire House in a Dying Dialogue for 2017 next Monday on October 16th with a reception starting at 6 p.m. and talk at 7 p.m. at the Lorton Performance Center on the TU campus, co-sponsored by Claire House, Magic City Books, University of Tulsa, and OU Tulsa. Lucy Kalanathi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. See you next week.
Yeah, we look forward to your visit. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.